This sermon was recorded at Christ Church Overland Park, a congregation that exists to be a people fully alive in God's kingdom.
This morning we are continuing in our series, Signs in John's Gospel. And we're looking at the fourth sign. There's seven signs. We're looking at the fourth one this morning, the feeding of the 5,000. And this, as John describes it, is a sign. It signifies something. It signifies something beyond itself. And this story is clearly very important because it's the only miraculous story that's recorded in all four Gospels except the resurrection itself. And that means the people closest to Jesus felt like that his story could not be told without this story. And we don't know exactly why, but perhaps it's due to the scale of this sign. 5,000 men suggests that there were probably 15,000, maybe more people there. They also, it's clear, they also believed that this sign, it pointed to Jesus as the fulfillment of a very important Old Testament prophecy. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15, Moses says this, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him." And over time, that really took on messianic significance, that this prophet predicted by Moses wouldn't be just a prophet, it would be the prophet. And so Moses, you know, the Lord through Moses provides manna to the Israelites in the wilderness. And now Jesus, you know, performs this sign of multiplying the bread for a huge crowd. And that's why John tells us, after the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." So for them, this sign was really loaded with all kinds of religious significance. Now, as we dig into this text, we also need to keep in mind the vast differences between their culture and ours. You know, modern, affluent Western culture, we entertain ideas about food that no other culture has ever done before. I can illustrate this with two simple questions, just the vast differences. If you were to be asked this question, how would you answer? What is the staple food in the United States? Yeah, pizza, whatever, who knows? I mean, it's a difficult question because there's so many different people from places all over the world. We import food from everywhere. Our diets are extremely diverse. But in many parts of the world, if you were to ask what is the staple food, you would get a very simple answer. Beans, rice, you know, maybe fish. In ancient Palestine, the diet was bread and maybe some fish. The second question, why do we work? We would have a bunch of different answers to that question. Why do we work? What we would probably not say is we work to eat. But in ancient Palestine, the typical person's income, 85% of it went to buy food. So if you don't work, you don't eat. Now, I'm not saying that our ideas and excess with food, you know, that's a whole nother point. We could spend a lot of time talking about that. I just really want to highlight that the Bible was written in a non industrialized, poor, agrarian society. And therefore, their mental associations with a word like bread are vastly different than ours. You know, for them, bread literally was life. Without it, they die. So, trying to keep those things in perspective, I want to look at this sign from three different kind of angles, through three different people, if you will. First, Jesus issues a challenge to Philip and to the other disciples. Second, he extends a special invitation to the boy in the story. And then third, Jesus provides a feast for the multitude. So there's a challenge, there's an invitation, and then there's a feast. So let's start with the challenge. The crowds have followed Jesus all the way to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And in Matthew's gospel, he tells us at this event that it was a remote place and it was getting towards evening. So people have probably not eaten all day. They're hungry. And Jesus challenges Philip with a question. Where shall we buy bread for all these people to eat? And there is no place to buy bread for these people. It's a test. And Philip replies, you know, as if even there was a place to buy this bread. He says, like, look, it would take half a year's wages just to buy enough bread for everybody to have a crumb, just one bite. In other words, Philip's saying, it's not possible. It's a ridiculous question. Peter's brother, Andrew, he brings the boy who has the five loaves and the two fish. But Andrew and Philip, they all know this is not nearly enough food, obviously, to feed this huge crowd. But regardless, Jesus, you know, asks the boy for the food, and he tells everyone to sit down. He gives thanks, and then they distribute the food, and there is enough for everyone. There's even 12 baskets of leftover. And again, this was a test for Philip and the other disciples. Would Philip look for an obvious natural solution to this problem? Or would he look beyond the natural into the supernatural and ask Jesus to provide? That was the test he was given. And we see, what we see as a result of all this is this miracle really of epic proportions. This tiny bit of food is multiplied to feed a crowd of probably around 15,000 people. I mean, it's arresting to our minds. It challenges us, challenges all of our intellectual categories. So much so that for centuries, scholars have tried to figure out a way, like, how could this have, you know, kind of naturally happened? But for the gospel writers, that is to miss the point entirely. This is a sign that demonstrates that Jesus is not just some great teacher or prophet. This is a sign that tells us he is divine. He is the prophet. He has supernatural power in his person. Philip and the disciples did not see this coming. Neither did the crowds, but we can see by their reaction that they were awestruck. It says they wanted to force him to become king. If this guy can just provide bread for us, then hey, we want him. So it was really a challenge to Philip and the disciples intellectually, but it's even more of a challenge for us. Our modern scientific age, we just don't believe that things like that can happen. We know better. We know better. They can't happen because they don't fit within our materialistic categories. Deep down, almost all of us, deep down, only believe things exist that we can touch, that we can measure, that we can verify. There's a famous Catholic philosopher. He's very old now. He's in his 90s. His name is Charles Taylor. And he's really a heavyweight in the philosophical world. And he's written several really groundbreaking books. One of them is called The Secular Age. And in this book, Taylor traces how it has come to be in our modern world where we understand ourselves, our society, and the world around us in purely secular terms, without any reference. So we understand ourselves and the world around us without any reference to the divine or to the transcendent. And what Taylor interestingly argues is that this is true for religious believers as much as it is true for atheists. That it's actually just become, we have become so materialistic, it's just our default mode. That we only believe those things that we can see, that we can measure, that we can touch. And he talks about how that is such a radical departure from how most people have ever lived in the world. And certainly very different than the worldview of Jesus' day, when really God was understood to be kind of permeated in and through every aspect of life and culture. So if this was an intellectual challenge for Philip and the disciples, it's even more so an intellectual challenge to us to look to the supernatural power of Jesus. And this sign really caused Philip and the disciples and the whole crowd to rethink some things. Because everything has to be reevaluated if Jesus can feed a crowd of 15,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. If he has that kind of power in his person, then he is more than just simply a good teacher. And if he is more, well, then what in the world do we do with that? So in this sign, Jesus really issues an intellectual challenge to us all. Now, the second perspective that I'd like us to consider is that of this little boy. There really aren't any details about him in the story except that he has these 5 loaves and 2 fish. We do know it says that they were barley loaves, and barley was the grain used to make bread for the poor. Wealthy people didn't eat barley. It wasn't as good as wheat. And so it was for the common poor people. So we know that about him, probably, that he was poor. We know that he certainly wouldn't have been there alone. He was with his family. So maybe he's, you know, maybe that's his task. He's carrying the family's food with him. We don't know. But we can imagine his hesitation when Jesus says, "Hey, let me have your food." You know, we can imagine him thinking, "Wait, but this is for my family. This is all we have." But from his food, Jesus provides an abundance for this huge crowd. You know, throughout the Gospels, we see that Jesus' miracles, they're not simply displays of raw power. Jesus isn't just showing off. His miracles are very specifically to show us who he is and what he came to do. He's typically reversing something that is broken. He's not trying to entertain us. His power is manifested, again, to show us who he is and what he came to do. For example, God is working against hunger in the world. So Jesus does what? He feeds the multitudes who are hungry. God is working against isolation and loneliness. So what does Jesus do? Well, he heals the leper. He heals the outcast in society so that that person can be reintegrated into community. God is working against physical sickness and death. So Jesus heals the blind man and resurrects his friend Lazarus. There's a German theologian. He also is very up in age and in upper 90s now. His name is Jürgen Moltmann. And he says something very fascinating, I think, about Jesus' miracles. He says this, Jesus' healings are not supernatural miracles in a natural world. Let me say that again. Jesus' healings are not supernatural miracles in a natural world. They are the only truly natural thing in a world that is unnatural, demonized, and wounded. Jesus' miracles don't subvert the natural world. Rather, they show us how the world should be, the way God intended. God created the world, and he declared it all very good. But through the fall, everything became corrupted and subject to decay. But now, in and through Jesus, God is doing the kingdom work of new creation. God is remaking the world as it should be. But the Gospels tell us that Jesus has now ascended. He's ascended into heaven. He's not physically here anymore. He's ascended into heaven. And so, how is he still at work remaking the world? Well, he has sent his Spirit to anoint his body on earth, which is what we call the church. He has sent his Spirit to anoint his body on earth with power and authority to go and do in his name all the same things that he did. And so that means we are, as we so often would say, the hands and feet of Jesus in this world. We continue the work of subverting the way things are for the way that God wants them to be. Feeding the hungry, healing the sick, protecting the vulnerable, fighting against evil and injustice. And you may think, and rightfully so, the problems are just too big. They're too complex. We don't have the human and financial resources to really make much of a difference. That's all true. And that's exactly what Philip and the disciples thought. What are 5 loaves and 2 fish among so many? But Jesus didn't feed the multitudes from nothing, even though he easily could have done so. He didn't feed them from nothing. He fed them from something. The little boy gave him what he had. It wasn't much, but he gave him what he had. And Jesus multiplied it into this feast. That's what Jesus continues to do. Yes, the problems are immense. They are extremely complicated. We do not have the wisdom, the skills, the time, the resources to solve all these problems. We don't. But Jesus didn't ask the boy for what he didn't have. He asked him for what he had. And the same is true for us. You know, our problem is not that Jesus asks for more from us than we have to give. He doesn't. Our problem is that oftentimes we are not willing to give him what we have. Whether it's our time or our resources, our skills, our talents, whatever it is, we want to hang on to it. We want our lives to be nice and neat and tidy. And I am first in line in that. But Jesus says, hey, he invites us in this story, this sign, he invites us to say, here's what I have. And then watch him multiply it into something beyond anything we could really imagine. So Jesus issues an intellectual challenge to Philip and the disciples, and then on to us, to look beyond the material world to Jesus' power to provide. He extends a special invitation to the boy and then to us to give him what we have so that he can multiply it for his kingdom. And finally, Jesus provides a feast for the multitudes, both 2,000 years ago in Galilee and to everyone who looks to him in faith. You know, as amazing as this miracle was, Jesus actually rebukes the people for being so enamored with it. Verse 26 and 27, he says, "Truly I tell you, you are looking for me, not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you." They were amazed by the sign, but they failed to see where it pointed. And this is why in verse 34, they're still asking for bread. They're not getting it. And so Jesus even says explicitly, "I am the bread. I'm the whole point. I'm why I did this. So that you'll figure it out. You'll see me and who I am." But they didn't understand. They missed it. Jesus is saying, look, there's this bread. I'm talking about bread that's even more important than the kind of bread that feeds your physical body. I'm talking about a kind of bread that gives you eternal life. I'm talking about a bread that if you eat it, you'll never be hungry again. And he's saying, I am that bread. The whole point of this sign was to point you to me. Well, this conversation goes on. It goes on through the whole chapter of John chapter 6. And I didn't want to do that to you, make you read the whole chapter. But verse 51, so that they're still talking about bread. They're still not getting it. And so he says again, "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever." He's already said that, so he's saying it again. And now he says this. He's like, okay, I gotta make it even clearer for you. "This bread is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world." And their response is, "You want us to eat your flesh?" I mean, Jesus is not talking about cannibalism, is he? Of course not. So what does he mean? And this is a really good question for us. What does Jesus mean? How does Jesus become bread that we can eat? How does Jesus become bread, and how do we eat that bread so that we can live forever? You know, Stephanie and I went to this wonderful restaurant not too long ago, and the meal was delicious, especially the bread. It was so good. Homemade bread, warm, put the butter on there. It's like so good. Like, you just like, okay, I could be done right now. But of course I wasn't. I kept eating. But how was that bread made? Well, at the most basic level, wheat had to be crushed. Wheat, in essence, had to die so it could be made into bread that we could eat. I also had chicken, which was delicious. And it, too, had to die. That chicken gave its life so that I could eat it and live. You know, we are so far removed from agriculture, most of us, that this basic principle, it gets lost on us. Because we don't literally go out back and get the chicken and cut its head off and gut it and clean it and then cook it. When we eat, something has to die. If I am to live, something has to die. And in an agrarian society where the staple diet was bread, everyone knew that either the bread, the wheat, and the barley was crushed and died, or they died, because the bread was life. And maybe what Jesus is talking about is becoming a little clearer. Either he dies, or we die. He is the bread of heaven. Isaiah 53 says he was, what? Crushed for our iniquities. He gives his life for us. And maybe Jesus' words in John 12 are in some of your heads. Unless a grain of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So for us to gain Jesus' life, we have to feed on him. How do we do that? Well, Jesus tells us in part where we didn't read, we have to believe in the one whom God has sent. We feed on him by believing, by putting our faith, putting our trust in him. And that's why when we issue the invitation to come to communion, we always say what? Feed on him in your hearts, not your stomachs, your hearts. And how? By faith and with thanksgiving. He is the bread of heaven, not just because he came down from heaven, but because he came down from heaven and gave his life for us. He died so that we might live, and now he lives so that we might die to our selfish way of life and live for him. You know, that feeding is a much greater miracle than the feeding of the 15,000 people. By giving his life for us, Jesus has provided a feast for a multitude that John tells us in Revelation 7, no one can number. He says, I saw a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. And they cried out in a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. So Jesus says, look, I am the bread. I am the bread that came down from heaven. And whoever eats this bread, whoever puts their faith in me, will live forever. That is the challenge of this sign. Do we believe that? Are we willing to take that step of belief and put our trust that that is true? I'm banking my life on it. And I hope that you are too. There's only one way to discover if it's true or not, and that's to take that step of faith. Will you please stand?